Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You're on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps. Our technologies, markets, and cultural institutions, once forces for human connection and expression, now isolate and repress us. It's time to remake society together. Not as individual players, but as the team we actually are, Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, author of John Dee and the Empire of Angels, Enochian Magic and the Occult Roots of the Modern World, Jason Liu.
Now that we're going into the world of AI, well, we need to be very, very careful about what assumptions we bring into that, because we're going to be living in a world of gods and monsters very shortly. Real ones, technologically real ones.
Jason will be helping us see how the intentions we bring into the world of artificial intelligence could set something in motion from which it's hard to return. It's time to intervene on behalf of people. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. We'll be talking about magic and alchemy today with our guest Jason Liu, and I was researching his work, and I was surprised to see he also offers a course in the blockchain alongside all of his magical and alchemical stuff. And it's not really that odd. I've always thought about the blockchain as a form of alchemy itself. And I guess it's fitting because we're just recovering from Blockchain Week here in New York, where hundreds of people have gathered to talk about blockchains and compare their token offerings and look at the various applications of blockchain to everything from supply chain management to communal management. And I had to do a couple of talks at some of these events, and I guess at this point, something of a blockchain skeptic, and for a number of reasons. I mean, I think it's a great technology. I've always liked pretty good privacy as a way of authenticating an email, and I can understand now using that to authenticate transactions and show the banks and all the middlemen that we don't really need them in order to establish identity and have a trusted transaction. But what I keep looking at, and I guess this is as a media or technology theorist, at, you know, what is the blockchain retrieving? You know, whenever Marshall McLuhan, a great media theorist, was looking and evaluating a medium or a technology, he always looked at what is it retrieving? What does the automobile retrieve? It retrieves the chariot. You know, what is a different, what's being brought? What's culturally coming back? What values is it going to espouse? And as I look at the blockchain and the history of currency and money and transaction, I'm not so sure that blockchain retrieves the very best mechanisms for value exchange. We've talked a lot on this show about how originally, the first real currency was gold. and how it was a real problem for people because if you had any gold, you hoarded it, you stored it, you weren't going to trade it. Peasants didn't get any gold. Gold was really a currency only for long-distance trade between monarchs and really wealthy merchants. And it wasn't until market money was invented really by the peasants, or first used by the peasants and imported really from the Ottoman Empire, wasn't until market monies came about, these sort of low-cost poker chips, really, that were issued in the morning and that expired at night, that people got to use money, that market monies were really just ways of priming the pump at the market for exchange. And that's what got people so wealthy. That's what led to the middle class. And then they were made illegal by the monarchs because the monarchs couldn't control commerce if everybody was using all of these low-cost local currencies. Instead, they made people borrow money at interest from the central treasury. And this is what allowed really the rich to stay rich simply by being rich, and everyone else in the real economy really just to serve this interest-bearing, growth-based economy. So we've talked a lot about that. But what does the blockchain retrieve? Does it retrieve the low-cost, valueless market monies of the late Middle Ages that let people be rich? No, it retrieves gold. The blockchain is a way of keeping a currency scarce. It's not a way of reestablishing the trust that people learn to have of one another in a credit-based local market. It's a way of substituting for trust in a new way. So instead of using a big bank to substitute for the fact that you and I don't trust each other, now we've got all of this technology to substitute for trust. So it doesn't engender trust. It doesn't engender community. It substitutes for it. It's really just, you know, a ledger with benefits. The idea is that you go onto a blockchain and you're going to use all this new way of exchanging and tracking value, but the secret sauce is that you're also getting these tokens, which may just be super valuable someday. Now, there's other ways to use blockchain, and I appreciate them. So you could use blockchain, say, to prove that a coffee bean came from, free trade. There were no slaves involved. So we can trace this little coffee bean all the way back to where it came from. And that might be good for a business to know as a way of tracking things. But is that really the way that, say, a brand or a coffee merchant is going to be selling its coffee? Are you going to go into a coffee shop? And is the way that the coffee seller, the barista, whoever's there, are they going to prove the slave-free quality of their coffee by showing you the blockchain? You know, is that going to be the way a great coffee brand shows its competitive advantage over the other coffee brands? Is that the way that a brand should be establishing its trust by showing its blockchain number? I don't really know. You know, the real shift here should be that we could use technologies to move money from really a noun to a verb, that we can make money less something that you save and store as a way of proving your value, but really more of a way to promote transactions and movement between people. The object of the game should be to make money as worthless as possible so that it's biased towards flow and spending and exchange, not saving and hoarding and shielding and protection. You know, the social good people, they really see the blockchain as a way of making visible all the value that people are creating for one another, but not getting rewarded for. Jaron Lanier has written beautifully on the idea that instead of having all our value and data extracted by social media platforms, that we should find a way to record and value all of those microtransactions, all of that micro extraction. And the blockchain, to the extent that it could be used to label every single little transaction, every way we've created value, you know, in some ways, that's the libertarians' wet dream, that everything is quantifiable in terms of transaction. That waking up in the morning, well, if I get out on the left side of the bed versus the right, how could that data be used by bed manufacturers or sleep specialists? And then how can I be rewarded for that? So if everything I do is somehow tracked and registered as valuable data, then our entire reality can become transactionalized. I don't see that as a positive step, particularly because we're going to be constantly looking, well, how is this action a transaction? How is this a transaction? And the things that I do that aren't recognized as transactional still don't end up on the ledger. We're trying to move all of human reality to that ledger. And that's not the direction I think we should be going. I don't think that brings us further toward human trust. It doesn't recognize all that liminal stuff, all the weird stuff. When I look at the way culture is moving, I don't see young people moving towards an increasingly transactional reality. I see them buying LPs instead of digital files, not just out of nostalgia, but out of recognition that there's something else. It's not measurable. It's not mathematical. It doesn't fit on the ledger. I think the object of the game is to take as much human activity as we can off the ledger and back into that soft, squishy place where human beings really live. You're on Team Human. Our guest today, the author of John Dee and the Empire of Angels, Jason Louvre. Lots of good changes happening with Team Human. We're about to start broadcasting on some terrific community radio stations, giving Team Human more of the terrestrial footprint I believe it deserves. We're also booking our Team Human live events. We'll be in New York at the Alchemist's Kitchen on Thursday, June 22nd, with the founder of Soma Space, Mark Filippi. And then in London on July 9th with biologist Rupert Sheldrake and cyberpunk queen Pat Cadigan. More on all of this at teamhuman.fm very shortly. I don't know anyone who has thought more about the way our stories and technologies conjure new realities than Jason Louvre. He's the author of a number of books about the relationship of magic to culture and power, including most recently, John Dee and the Empire of Angels. So, anyway, I think you and I first met through Richard Metzger in Disinformation, wasn't it?
We did. That's right.
Were you at DisinfoCon?
I was not at DisinfoCon, but I started working for Disinfo shortly thereafter, I was interning for Disinfo remotely when the con happened. But I had kind of been in this, which is one of the reasons why it's so cool to be on the show. You know, I grew up as a teenager reading your books and reading, you know, The Invisibles and reading Disinfo and all of this stuff thinking that's what I wanted to do with my life, you know. And then, and so I kind of ended up working for Disinfo right out of college. So I was I became the books editor for Disinfo in 2003, I think. And then,
Was that editing books or was that writing about books?
It was both. It was doing all the editing on the print books they were putting out, the copy editing, and then running their...
Right, like You Are Being Lied To and the Book of Lies and those kind of books.
Right, right. And so it was from that kind of, you know, nexus that I was in that I ended up, you know, meeting Genesis and kind of just being thrown headfirst into the deep end of the counterculture.
Well, it was an interesting moment, too. I mean, I remember if people want to see what we were all like back then. I mean, you can find a lot of the stuff on YouTube. The DisinfoCon was probably in like 98 or 99. And it was this gathering of, you know, people like me, Richard Metzger, Robert Anton Wilson, Joe Coleman. Maybe Penny Arcade might have been there. And so it was this sort of magical early cyber moment where it felt like kind of anything was possible, and the counterculture had sort of won the war of a sort. And now we had these tools at our disposal to remake reality, to our own design, which maybe we still do. And I remember Grant Morrison, the comic book writer, he got up there and, you know, he was stoned or drinking, you know, he like chugged like two or three pints and then started talking about chaos magic in a way as if to say, look, this is what corporations do. This is a sigil. Here's how you make a sigil. You just take a word and you take out the vowels and smush it together into this symbol. And then you can, you know, have an orgasm or burn it or get stoned. And then it will happen. It'll just happen. So it seemed as if he was espousing a path to magic that a lot of young people liked. And you talked about in your book, Generation mm-hmm. Hex, this sort of, I guess this is what chaos magic was, right? It's like magic with no rules, or you just do it magic, sort of Nike magic or something.
Right. And that's kind of like the opening sales pitch of it, you know. And but, you know, from my perspective, so I was one of those kids, right? I was one of the kids reading Disinfo and reading, consuming all this material and going for it 100% to the point that I've really made it my life's path. I mean, it's been almost 20 years later now. And I've spent that 20 years immersing myself in magic and the occult and, but not just in the chaos magic sense, in the sense of, you know, I've really spent a lot of time, you know, kind of embedded as it were in lots of shamanic world cultures. So the meditation traditions in Hinduism and Buddhism, Sufism, Masonry, I was initiated as a shaman in Nepal, like all of this stuff. And I've spent, you know, 20 years kind of on script as it were, you know, I never left the disinfo moment. But one of the reasons why, I mean, you mentioned that utopian feeling, and one of the, you know, I remember so clearly being, you know, 20, 21 years old and just feeling like this was it, this was the future. And then, you know, all of a sudden we got 9/11. And so I've also really spent the last 20 years, you know, trying to figure out what happened. And I'm sure you remember the part, and this is why I wrote this book, you know, John Dee and the Empire of Angels. So I'm sure you remember the scene in the original Star Trek where sometimes things would go wrong on the ship and Scotty and Kirk would have to climb into the engineering shafts to figure out what had gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I've been trying to do for Western civilization. It's like, what went wrong in the source code? Why did we, you know, we were just at the crest of this wave where, to me at least, it felt like it was going to be Burning Man everywhere. And we were going to get the Mondo 2000 utopian society. And instead we went back to this kind of crusader script with, you know, this, you know, the Bush, the second Iraq war. And now we've ended up with Trump and Bannon and all, like, you know, waves of horror. Why did this happen? And so I've been trying to, from a magical standpoint, and I really define magic, I think, in probably the same way you do, which is, you know, magic is just the stories about what reality are, and the fact that those stories can become real once we believe them, in the sense that people start acting as if they're real. What is the meaning that humanity assigns to its experience? And so, you know, why did we go from what in my mind was the perfect script for the forward continuation of culture, which was Mondo 2000, Siberia, all of this, to, you know, why did we suddenly end up back in the Middle Ages, you know, back in the Crusades?
Well, and why did we? I mean, on a certain level, ending up back in the Middle Ages is the necessary and appropriate retrieval of, you know, the systems, the ideas that we left behind. The Renaissance itself was largely a repression of, well, certainly of magic and of women and of herbs and of local currencies and city-states, as we move towards this real abstract nationalism that we're still contending with today.
In a sense, yeah. But also the Renaissance, you know, as I've uncovered in this book, the Renaissance was really the time that the magical tradition was created, you know, the Western esoteric tradition. And it was created in the Medici city-states by essentially, you know, intellectuals and monks who had just gotten access to the works of Plato and Aristotle for the first time, and were trying to synthesize that back into Western culture. And so they incorporated all the stuff that you're talking about, folk magic and all of that, into this idea of that there could be an operative magical system that could somehow be turned into a science. And I really relate it to what's happening now with Silicon Valley, because the Medici city-states at this time were, you know, this incredibly wealthy part of the world that was just far, you know, just far above and beyond everyone else in terms of wealth, and was kind of this elite, and were looking for this Faustian technology that would take them even further, which at that time was magic. And now, of course, it's Silicon Valley with, you know, artificial intelligence, or perhaps things like blockchain or machine learning and automation and other things like that. So it's a very interesting parallel. But what I really discovered also in researching this is that magic never ended. It just was kind of kept behind closed doors for, you know, elites in society, if you will, not in a conspiratorial way, but in a sense that it was really an elite pursuit, but a pursuit that was responsible for many things like the birth of science, you might argue, came out of this intellectual stream, the creation of America even. But at the same time, it's been wrapped up with this idea of the apocalypse and the idea of causing the apocalypse to save the world. And that right there is, I think, the core piece of bad code in Western civilization that we're still left with today, and is fueling a lot of our assumptions that, you know, we may be unfortunately taking with us into the future as we with new technologies like the ones I've mentioned.
Right. So there's these magical traditions, and some of them are, you know, can't even call traditions, there, you know, ancient stuff. There's this magic stuff, and then there's this kind of nationalism and empire and Judeo-Christian thing. And so you wrote this book about John Dee, who's an Elizabethan magician advisor to Queen Elizabeth. And he's like super smart. He's clearly super smart. And he's done all this research into the kinds of things that you've researched, from, you know, Sufism meditation and Middle Eastern traditions and shamanic traditions. And he's seeing it all as different ways of connecting to this Enochian universe, right?
Yes. And John Dee was really, he was kind of like the Stephen Hawking of his day. I mean, he was this incredibly lauded scientist. He spent the whole first 50 years of his life kind of as he was considered the smartest guy in England. He had 5 times the books of Oxford and Cambridge. He was a government agent. He was actually called 007 in the British Secret Services, and then got 007. So he was instrumental in starting MI5, what became MI5 and MI6, and was really instrumental.
So they had MI5 and MI6
inklings
way back. I mean, the inklings of it, this is sort of Secret Service back in Queen Elizabeth time.
Right. It was started by John Dee and then Sir Francis Walsingham under Elizabeth I's administration. In a lot of ways, the Elizabethan period gives us the modern world, in as much as it gives us, yes, that those intelligence agencies, it gives us, you know, Shakespeare, who kind of defines what a human being is. And then it also, during this time, John Dee creates the phrase British Empire. He's the one who came up with that meme. And that meme, he said, was given to him by an angel in an occult ritual, who told him that there should be a British Empire that spans the entire world in order to spread the ideals of what you might consider, you know, the Protestantism and humanism around the world, as opposed to the top-down control of the church.
Right. So John Dee, though, wants to replace the top-down control of the church, which I guess is either the Catholic Church at that time, but replace it with the top-down control of these, like, angel characters.
Right. This is just absolutely crazy, right? Like, this is one of those moments where when you really dig into history, you start to realize that the history is more bizarre than the strangest, like, Alex Jones conspiracy theories, right? Particularly because it's actually verifiable. And that is that, you know, John Dee spent 10 years. So again, if you imagine Dee as Stephen Hawking, you know, what, by the time that he was 50, Dee then said, you know what, I'm going to dedicate the next 10 years of my life to doing occult rituals to contact angels. And the example that I give is if it would be as if Stephen Hawking had said, okay, you know, I've really made it as a scientist. Now I'm going to spend 10 years smoking DMT trying to talk to aliens. You know, it's that same kind of left turn. But during these sessions, which he, you know, allegedly, you know, like there's lots of ways to interpret it, whether it was actually happening or it was just in his head or he was being conned. He was working with a psychic named Edward Kelly, and they spent 10 years, you know, writing over 1,000 pages of records of talking to these, what they said were angels. One of the ideas that emerged from this was that not only should there be a British Empire, but that there should be a worldwide empire of angels, which is, you know, one new world order, one unifying religion, unifying Protestantism, Catholicism, Judaism, Islam, and even paganism, and that it should be controlled terrestrially by Elizabeth. So it should be a spiritual and terrestrial totalizing empire.
Right. So this is way bigger than like Seth Speaks and telling you to eat raw almonds to prevent, you know, cancer. The angels, I mean, because, you know what I mean, the kind of channeling we get today doesn't have this kind of content. So the he's doing all these rituals and things and channeling and vision quests and communicating with these entities, whether they're the machine elves of McKenna or the angels of the Bible, whatever they are. And they're saying, okay, it's angel time. And the way we're going to bring about angel time and exercise this true, great occult, you know, realization and ultimately bring on utopia is we're going to follow the Christian model and bring on an apocalypse. And to do that, we need to have this giant empire to create a kind of a one world government to administrate this up.
Right, right. And they wanted... So as part of the sessions, they gave Dee the schematics to build what's called the Holy Table of Practice, which is kind of like the world's most complicated Ouija board,
yeah.
Which is a setup that you would use to talk to the angels. So they wanted one of these in basically every household, like a TV, so that everyone would be able to make their own direct contact with spiritual entities, basically because they were very frustrated with the state of, you know, mortal religion, if you would call it that, and the Protestant Reformation. If you can imagine a world like that. I mean, I know Brian Geisen wanted something similar where he wanted a dream machine in every house instead of a TV, right? But we can only fathom what this would be like, a world in which people were, immersed in occult rituals to contact angels instead of watching cops on TV. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a crazy idea. And of course, well, we could say, well, that clearly didn't happen. Although I don't know, if you kind of look sideways and look at, you know, I don't know, global capitalism, monoculture, globalization, which really kind of is an extension of Protestantism in a strange way with the Protestant work ethic and the idea of, you know, working yourself to the death to build the spiritual utopia that really was the foundational kind of ideological DNA of America. In a way, it kind of did happen in a strange way. And so this is what I mean in the sense of crawling into the engineering tunnels. It's just like, why did the world become, okay, well, first of all, why did, you know, the brutal legacy of the British Empire and then the American Empire that came out of it and the deforestation and the degradation of the natural world and the enslavement of people and the paving over of indigenous religions. Well, when you suddenly understand that these ideas came out of an occult ritual, well, that makes, it's kind of a strange, gives you a strange way to look at things and a sideways way to look at things.
I know. And it's, I guess what it comes down to for me is then you spend 20 years looking through some of the same, you know, byways and highways of people like John Dee. And it makes me wonder, is there a there? You know, sometimes when I read these guys or read Crowley or somebody, it seems like what they're saying is, well, look, we can use this, all this magic stuff is sort of the story through which we convince people to sign on to this, you know, to obey our empire because it's the ultimate black box. You know, we've been there, we've talked to the angels, it's there, this is real power, you know, just obey, you know? Right. And do you think that there's a there that there are these entities that were speaking with D and trying to assist them or to get D to enlist D and Queen Elizabeth in this, you know, angel technology stuff? Or do you think that there was some cynicism and manipulation involved?
I think it could have been both. I have to come to the conclusion that I don't think that I think that D was 100% sincere. Now, he could have been manipulated by Kelly, his psychic, and there could have been other things going on. But I think the more broad answer to your question, you know, after 20 years, I think that, well, I'm with, you know, Crowley said something at one point that's, you know, if you do certain things will happen. Like, you know, if you follow certain ritual procedures, you will have very strange experiences. You know, now whether those are objectively real, that's a whole other question. So I think that when we get into the domain of magic, what we're really talking about is not anything that's objectively true. We're talking about the human process of subjectivity and how we generate subjectively meaningful experiences, or how we overlay subjective meaning onto the objective material truths of the world. But a more specific way to say that is, you know, I love the example of a stage magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat, right? Whereas, you know, a stage magician is in the business of producing illusions to impress people. A real magician, or at least a magician who's interested in exploring consciousness in a sincere way, is very much about removing illusions. And what I mean by that is, if you do a lot of these occult rituals, so for instance, yoga, long meditation, ritual, or, you know, entheogens, things like this in a ritual context, you'll have crazy experiences. You'll have experiences that are no different than perhaps what were reported by biblical prophets or shamans or yogis from the records that we read. And you'll have the same experiences. But at the same time, you'll then understand why you had those experiences. You'll understand, well, I just did a certain set of processes through yogic breathing or ritual that's clearly triggered something in my nervous system that I could see that somebody could easily interpret as something mystical happening. And so in a way, when we do magic, we almost disprove, or not as much disprove them as you see how the rabbit's pulled out of the hat. You see how the sausage is made. You see that if you do certain yogic practices or rituals, you will have sacred experiences. And I think that a cynical person would look at that and say, aha, that proves it. You know, oh, this is all nonsense. This is just some type of nervous system event. It's just something firing in your brain. I've disproven all of religion. But I think that a more creative thinker or a magical thinker might look at that and say, well, aha, now I know how to pull the rabbit out of the hat. You know, that was kind of fun. Let's do that again. You know, can we do that on demand? Can we get people who are totally kind of cynical and disempowered and feel adrift in the world to do things like this and generate a sense of meaning and connectedness in their lives? You know, what would that be like?
Right. I mean, we see the beginnings of it. I mean, even in what you might consider unenlightened places, you know, they're doing, you know, ecstatic rituals and, you know, dancing with snakes. And I mean, they're having experiences, you know, even if they're, you know, they're not like us, they're not, you know, counterculture advocates. They're still people who are touching these places.
Right. I think that it's part of the human experience. I think that magic is really, magic is a word for the way that humans generate meaning out of their experience. I think it's something that is a spontaneous, you know, after, you know, again, 20 years of looking at this stuff, I don't think it's that complicated or special. I think that it's and I don't think that it's something that you have to jump through a lot of hoops to do. I think that it's magic is kind of an emergent property, if you will, of the human meaning-making faculty. And it seems of, you know, nature and the universe itself, where you know, meaningful patterns and meaningful experiences seem to just emerge of their own accord when you're looking for them. But that said, it's, you know, one thing that's really come home to me, where I started with the assumption that magic was a kind of a special activity, that it was, you know, that it was a counterculture thing, that it was, you know, it was a punk rock thing. The conclusion that I really have to come to is that's not the case. That it really is core to humans in all cultures at all times. You know, I mean, you can look at what Christians and, you know, fundamentalist Christians, some of the things they do are very magical. Anybody ascribed to any religion, there will be some magical parts of it. Anybody who's just engaged in trying to impose their will on the world. I mean, you could look at, as I do, you could look at computer code or business structure or marketing as all magical activities because they're methodologies for manipulating reality.
Well, language itself. I mean, you know, for people who didn't know what speech was, to watch a neighboring tribe using speech to organize themselves and give commands, was as magical to them as, you know, walkie-talkies would be to a non-technological civilization.
Absolutely. And this is actually core to John Dee's research, where the core of the Renaissance magical tradition, with the Holy Grail that they were looking for, was the primal language, the language that they believed would have been spoken by angels before the fall from the Garden of Eden, you know, in their way of seeing things. And they thought that if they found this language, which would be, I don't know, like the assembly language for reality, that they would be able to manipulate reality directly, just as God and the angels did. And so this is something that emerged out of the Dee's angelic sessions, where the angels gave him this language, allegedly, that he claimed was the original language that is now called Enochian, which has kind of become the core of the Western magical tradition ever since. And it's a language that at least people who are into this stuff believe, can directly modify reality, just like it was getting straight into the code.
I mean, the part that as I read the book, which is, you know, it's a great book, but the part about Dee and Elizabeth that then sort of rubbed me the wrong way, it's that they take these kind of, you know, timeless magical traditions, these almost, in a beautiful way, purposeless magical traditions, the pure pattern recognition and connection to reality and understanding, and then they by merging it with the kind of Judeo-Christian, future-based, progress-oriented, you know, bring on the messianic age structure, and marrying it to this kind of patriarchal, even if it's Elizabethan, you know, this kind of patriarchal domination of the planet, that they ended up with a hybrid, and a kind of a dangerous hybrid. You know, it was no longer, you know, shamans in the jungle seeing the, you know, recognizing the patterns of life and death and day and night and tribe and jungle. It was an empire really leveraging all of these insights. They were energized not just by magic, but by, you know, gunpowder and warships. And you know what I mean? It feels like kind of the wrong people got a hold of this stuff, and it didn't make them more loving or connecting. It really just made them want to dominate all the more.
Yeah. But I'll also say that it's not like those things had been separate before. Magic had come out of the Judeo-Christian context in this sense, or it was a part of the Judeo-Christian stream. But you could also argue that it's another case of, it's not necessarily a bad idea, but it's a good idea gone wrong, in the sense that, you know, Dee really wanted, what he really wanted was a world of intellectual freedom where people could pursue spiritual enlightenment on scientific lines. They could investigate science would not have happened without this work, and it's very likely. They wanted, in Dee and the 200 years after him, what they really wanted was to build a world that was free of the Inquisition and the control of the Catholic Church. And if they hadn't done it, then there probably would have been just a Catholic world empire. And instead, what we ended up with is kind of a cold war between, you know, metamagical systems, if you will, Protestantism and Catholicism. And so, but then, like, we fast forward and it's clear that, you know, this is all the process of, you know, imperialism and imperialist thinking. And it's why we've ended up where we are. And also, shockingly, it's not that different from, you know, the fundamental assumptions are not that different from, for instance, Ronald Reagan believing that he was shepherding the world towards the apocalypse. George Bush Jr. telling Jacques Chirac that he saw Gog and Magog at work in the Middle East. Or Mike Pence now, or the assumptions of people like Steve Bannon even, where they are still pushing for, you know, this kind of Christian apocalypse, Judeo-Christian apocalypse. And it's that set of assumptions that is behind things. I mean, when you understand that, you know, as there's a Pew Research study, Pew Forum study in 2006 that found, I think, one out of three Americans believes that it's the end of the world and Christ will return in our lifetime. When you understand that the Left Behind books are the most read books in America after the Bible, and I think before Stephen King at this point, you know, it's not like this is ancient history. It's a worldview that we're immersed in and that is now kind of enforced at the point of nuclear weapons, you know, even till now, till the invasion of, you know, what we're seeing in Syria now.
I mean, the reason why I'm interested in magic, and maybe not even in a practical way, is just to know it's there. The team human exploration really is about finding evidence and experiences that help, you know, celebrate and separate humanity from the systems in which we live. You know, I find if I go to the West Coast, I've got to at least once try to explain why human intelligence is different than machine intelligence, or why we can't upload consciousness to a chip, or why I think that our incarnate experience is not yet fully understood. And magic feels like, at least the kind of magic that I know, which is really super simple, is just looking at the patterns, recognizing patterns in the world around us, which is enough of a rabbit hole for pretty much any person to go into. When you start looking for patterns, you start seeing the patterns, whether it's Robert Anton Wilson seeing the number 23 or the Sirius star everywhere, you know, in everything he looks at, you start to see, oh, there are currents of some kind. Do you see magic as almost uniquely human?
In the sense of patterns, yeah, I think that, well, human beings are confirmation bias machines, right? We'll see patterns anywhere, no matter what, no matter who you are. I mean, all you have to do is look at a wall socket to see a face, right? And if you start doing, you know, these rituals and things like that, then yeah, you'll be seeing all these patterns. Like, but the really interesting thing about that is, okay, well, this is obviously just confirmation bias, right? You think that you're looking for something. It's kind of a perceptual flaw or feature, of human consciousness, where if we look for patterns, we'll see them. So if you look for the number 23, you'll see it everywhere. So somebody who gets into this stuff, who maybe is not very sophisticated about psychology, will think that messages are coming to them from the universe. It's like, oh, well, I'm seeing the number 23 everywhere. Therefore, the universe is talking to me directly, and I must be special and made for something greater, right? But then, you know, a more perhaps sophisticated person or somebody who understood cognitive biases would look at this and say, well, this is confirmation bias. You're just seeing patterns because you're looking for them. But then you can then spin that back around. And the conclusion I came to is, yeah, it is confirmation bias, but there's an even more interesting part of that, which is, wait, well, if I see what I look for, well, then maybe I should start looking for better things. Right. You know, it's like if I start looking for opportunities to be a more compassionate person, if I start looking for opportunities to, you know, help human evolution along, or even, you know, the most crass example, if I start looking for opportunities to gain personal wealth, something like that, well, then you're going to see them. Well, isn't that interesting? You know, I mean, you will see anything you look for because the universe is essentially infinite information. I mean, you can't look around your room that you're in and take everything in all at once. You know, if you change your focus to just looking for blue and then red and then green, you're going to have very different experiences of the room that you're sitting in.
Well, right. But sometimes the room itself can change. Mm. It's funny. I was talking to people about, you know, Facebook and social media lately and how people are getting upset by the reality that their social media is reflecting back to them. You know, they're upset that, gosh, the algorithms think I'm like this. You know, this is the news that they're giving me. And what I've been thinking lately is that, well, if you don't like the you that your social media is projecting back to you, what could you do to change its view of you? In other words, using the social media algorithm as a kind of a mirror. All right, because you clicked on this, you clicked on that. So obviously that's the kind of person it thinks you are. It thinks you're violent because you keep clicking on those violent stories. So if you want social media to reflect back to you a more peaceful person who likes kittens and love and wants to heal the world, then start clicking on those things and seeing what it brings back to you. But I mean, what you're saying is that the real world is kind of like this, that, you know, you kind of get out what you put in.
Yeah. Well, you get what you notice. And I think that, yeah. And by the way, I mean, doesn't the Facebook algorithm, doesn't that make the Robert Anton Wilson concept of the reality tunnel like so useful all of a sudden?
Right. Right. That here is it's a reality tunnel that you're in, only it's not solely constructed by your own mental limits or biases, but by they're being reinforced by a technology that's trying to read your reality tunnel and then, you know, construct a virtual version of it for you.
Totally. Which is, you know, quite sinister, particularly with the things that happened in the election. And anyone who's ever played with Facebook advertising knows how easy it is to or used Facebook for marketing knows how easy it is to manipulate perceptions in those ways. But, you know, the real core of the magical and, you know, the process of becoming, you know, more magical or shamanic or whatever you want to call it, getting more agency over reality, is understanding exactly what you're talking about in terms of having being able to shift between different reality tunnels, being able to shift between different ways of seeing the world. And one thing that I think that I've learned in my life so far, that was very surprising to me, is that I think when you meet anyone who's really had a real effect on culture or reality, and I'm sure probably almost all of the people listening to this show, you know, anyone who's interested in, you know, being part of Team Human or being part of the crew that is helping out on Spaceship Earth, well, those people, if you go back, probably without fail have had, you know, either a period of, you know, interest in psychedelics or meditation or some type of spiritual practice. And that might have just been in college. It might have just been in the early 20s. But that experience definitely had an impact on their future. I think Steve Jobs is a great example of that, right? In the sense that he was interested in psychedelics and meeting Eastern gurus and things like that. And it's been shocking to me how almost uniform that experience is in people who are kind of a little bit more awake and certainly more utopian. And I think, you know, and also the thing about researching, you know, looking at all these people who either created the British Empire or started, you know, naval startups to explore the new world or the space program with Jack Parsons, things like this, it's kind of always been this way. It's, you know, the magicians, if you will, or just the people who are a little bit more plugged in and just more intelligent and curious and creative and end up kind of becoming the Illuminati, if you will, in the sense that they're the ones who are helping tell the story of what reality is.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I would agree with you, but also push back. I mean, I feel like that, yes, among, you know, kind of a college educated white elites, those who have chosen to, you know, reflect on what's going on here, how can I make this world better? I mean, most of those people have been kind of shocked into that awareness through a spiritual practice or a guru or psychedelics or deep meditation or something. But there's a lot of people who come to these sensibilities through what might look to you know, psychedelic ravers, like extremely mundane connections to their world. You know, the people who are in flow of one kind or another, the permaculture farmer, the person cooking bread, baking bread right now. You know, there's such insights to be gained through, you know, simple hands-on connection to our world that, you know, you don't necessarily need the medicine to get back to it if that's where you are. You know, there's a I feel like a lot of us think, oh, well, you know, they're like back in some indigenous state or, you know, some ancient state, and they need to pass through this sort of industrial age awfulness in order to then, you know, more consciously seize these insights. But they're there, you know, they do seem to have this sensibility without having, you know, read the books or, you know, had the, you know, they don't know, you know, Leary and Burroughs. You don't necessarily need it. I'm wondering, I don't know.
I completely agree. And I think that this is kind of what I was touching on when I was saying that I think that magic is a spontaneously emergent principle out of human consciousness. I think that, you know, in a way, you know, like when you said, you know, like when privileged white guys get into magic, they tend to become imperialistic about it, and they tend to think they're a big deal. Then all of a sudden, you know, I'm the Magus of the Aeon and all this stuff.
Right. And you think about that first disinfo conference that we were talking about. I mean, and the magicians were who? You know, you know, it was Grant Morrison, Genesis P. Orridge, and Robert Anton Wilson, and Richard Metzger, and Joe Coleman, and me. I mean, there were not. There were a few women performance artists there, but they were not the ones standing up at the microphone and talking about their kind of macho sigils that they did.
Well, that's because they're the ones who are really good at magic, so they don't have to talk about it. But
right.
I think that one of the things that I've learned traveling in other cultures is how ubiquitous this is in the world. And I think that without like over romanticizing other cultures, in my interactions with people in, for instance, India or Thai people or people who are, or Mexico, you know, people who are kind of never left magical consciousness or integrated it into their culture in a way that whereas Western culture made a clear separation. They kind of seem to look at Western people like cats with their whiskers cut off in a way, where they kind of look at us like we're kind of missing something, like there's kind of something off about us. And I think what that is we're not aware. We don't still have that kind of innate magical consciousness that is so much a part of just daily life in so many places in the world. And as a result of that, I think that when people in our culture get into magic, they think they're a big deal, and they think it's a bigger deal than it really is. When I really think the truth is more like, well, we're just kind of, as a culture, kind of reclaiming something that we lost, but we're really behind a lot of the world in that sense. You know, where you know, people in developed first world nations are very, very ahead in technology, way ahead in terms of solving human problems with technology and things like this, than many impoverished places in the world. But a lot of those places, they have a much deeper and more precise understanding of spirit than we do. I mean, I think, you know, Tibetan Buddhism is a perfect example, but that's certainly not the only one. There's all these traditions all over the world. And so my progress, I think, just as a human being going through these things has not been about becoming some all-powerful uber magus. That's really an adolescent stage. It's just about becoming more human and trying to reclaim more of my humanity, which I think is what we need right now. I mean, not to be over dramatic about it. I mean, it's almost a cliche, but it's true.
Right. But so many of the Western magical traditions really do go back to this, become the uber magus dude, you know, build this global empire. I mean, if people like listening to this decide to pursue magic, are they going to end up finding these angels who tell them to take over the whole world?
Well, if they do Western magic, you know, but it's kind of like when I look at magic, so I use magic as a catch-all term to describe all of this stuff, you know, meditation, yoga, psychedelic, shamanism, spirituality, all this stuff, just because it's hard to say all that in one breath, and magic sounds really cool because it is cool. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Western magic is a very small subset of the broader magical world, and it's in many cases been a very broken part of it, in the sense that it has all these dominator ideas. It has this like ego pathology that you see people like Crowley running around in it with. And really, this book has also been my attempt to kind of patch the Western tradition and put it in proper historical context and understand what it was for. And I think that, but the broader answer is, you know, I don't think that Western culture ever stopped doing this. And it's just moved on. It became science, then it became, you know, high technology, things like this. And, you know, I saw, you just had Kenrick McDowell on a couple episodes ago. So Kenrick's right. a friend of mine. And actually, when I was working on this book, he contacted me to work with the AMI program at Google. And the question in my mind became, well, we're going into this world where we're building artificial intelligences. So forget the whole idea of spirits and gods and things like this. Or let's just look at spirits and gods as, you know, our models of what a superhuman intelligence should act like. Well, now that we're going into the world of AI, well, we need to be very, very careful about, because we're going to be living in a world of gods and monsters very shortly, and real ones, you know, technologically real ones. And so we have to be, in my opinion, very, very careful about what assumptions we bring into that. And I think that if we bring in, you know, these Western dominator ideals, imperial ideals, like we've been talking about, we're just going to be repeating all of the carnage of the Age of Empires on an even much, much more dangerous plane. So,
right. We've got way better tech now.
Yeah.
You know, we can't play a world war at this point without it being a real world war.
Right. Right. And, or potentially wiping out all human life. And I think that, you know, that's my great fear, is that we end up in a world which is purely mechanical, with no need, that's optimized out the need for biological life. You know, because I think that if you set up an AI to solve the problem of optimizing itself, that's probably the conclusion it would come to.
Right. But is that the committee of angels? I mean, is that what John Dee's angels would want? I mean, just humans to build this thing to, you know, just program their will and then have no people at all? Or are they nicer than that?
I think they're nicer than that. But my answer, you know, I think confronting the problem of AI is I do think that the best model for going into the AI age is not this kind of angelic empire thing. And in fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to make this very clear what's going on here. But I think that, you know, I have to say that I think something like the Buddhist idea of humanity as a network, you know, the whole Buddhist idea is that consciousness is a network between beings, and that actually the network connections are much more important, and the health of the network as a whole is what's valuable. So that, and that, you know, that's where the whole Buddhist idea of compassion comes from. The idea of compassion being, you know, compassion for all sentient and perhaps insentient life. And so I think that when we look at these things like these bodhisattvas and multi-armed beings, protecting and having compassion and guarding all life, you know, I think that's the set of things that we should be coding into AI. And we really do only have a short window of time in which human beings can still code an ethical system into AIs before they become self-replicating and the evolutionary algorithms take over to the point that they're writing their own code and we don't really have a say anymore. So we really do have a window of about 10 years to get the right assumptions about how superintelligences should behave into AI. And so this is what I'm trying to, you know, I think that I'm trying to bring to the conversation with my very kind of bizarre specialist background.
Right. But it's a tricky moment because, you know, as they just published, I think, in the New York Times, they were explaining how all the AI scientists are being, you know, scooped up from the universities and put directly to work at Google and Facebook. And all of the machine learning they're doing is about, you know, maximizing value extraction. They're not doing machine learning to figure out how to make us, you know, better, more communicative and connected people. They're just looking at how do we maximize short-term profit for a corporation. You know, and that's the whole of it.
It's terrifying.
It is terrifying because the way that, you know, corporations will make the most money may end up, well, it's interesting. I mean, if you read your Marx, in the end, in the long term, humans are the only ones that can create value. You know, finally, you still need humans. So maybe the AIs will be smart enough to realize, well, without any humans, there's no more value to extract. There's no, you need someone to exploit.
Yeah, it's crazy though. I mean, I was just a couple months ago, I was over in Berlin for a blockchain conference and people were bringing these ideas like, you know, not just self-driving, but self-owning cars. And somebody had the idea for like a self-owning forest that would move around on a platform and sell its carbon credits back for blockchain tokens. We're moving into a very, very strange world. But in terms of So when I really started, you know, when I really went down the AI rabbit hole and I just got the look of frozen horror on my face for about a month, I started reading. I realized there was no roadmap at all for where we are. And the only thing that I could come up with was looking at the writing of the scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project and understanding what their ethical reasoning was. And the terrifying thing that came out of this was that the ethical reasoning of all the scientists working on the bomb is the exact same as the scientists working on AI now, where they were all in their head, they said, they were all telling themselves, well, this is terrible and it's a terrible weapon, but if we don't create it, somebody else will, the Germans will create it, the Japanese will create it, and that will be even worse. So we have to create it. And that, and it's like that logic forces it to happen. And where we see now with AI, where we've got like 1,000, you know, companies working on AI, or Putin's working on AI, everybody's working on AI. And yes, it seems that Google has a substantial advantage. And that's maybe a good thing in the sense that Google is, you know, at least somewhere in the foundational DNA there, we have, you know, Burning Man people and Bay Area hippies and things like that. But at the same time, it's almost like the technology becomes inevitable because it becomes an arms race. And that's where we are right now. And that's very, very frightening. So my best hope is that the right people do it first, and they do it with put the right assumptions into it.
Right. So I guess in summary, what you're hoping is that by kind of exposing the long relationship between magic and magical thinking and practice with notions of sort of empire and apocalypse and sort of Judeo-Christian progress, you can help almost, I would think, almost separate them again, or allow people to you know, touch some of these abilities more for their sort of connective capacity than their conquering capacity.
Yeah, and it's not even about abilities per se, as it is the story. You know, what's the story? What's the story that we're telling ourselves? What's the story that we're taking into this? And I can already see people taking the apocalyptic story into AI. I think that, you know, Nick Land and accelerationism is a good example of that, of people bringing this apocalyptic type thinking. You know, really the apocalyptic idea, you know, the core bad idea in Western civilization is that the sooner we cause the apocalypse, the sooner Jesus will come back. Right. And it's like, it's an infantile belief. It's like the idea of a child, you know, well, if I destroy my room and write on all the walls with crayon, and just make a total mess, then mommy and daddy will come and pay attention to me, and they may be punishing me, but at least they'll be there, and then I will feel existentially safe in the universe. That's really all it
is. Better than nothing.
Right. And if we take that type of thinking into artificial intelligence and bioweapons and nanoweapons, we're screwed. So that's the core meme that we need to be aware of. And of course, it's responsible for all the wars we've been in for the last couple decades. So there's that too. You know, I think that models, not that they're perfect, but I think that models proposed by maybe Buddhism, for instance, and some of these other ways of looking at the world are at least worth investigating. You know, are there other assumptions that we can take into life? Can we, you know, see life as essentially fundamentally meaningless, but on which we can impose, you know, certainly the way that I look at what is reality at this point is there's no meaning to reality. It's fundamentally empty, but that in that, you know, the gods and the spirits and the magic and all that is not literally real, but is kind of human projected meaning onto random patterns. But in that understanding, coming to the very enchanted, the very magical viewpoint that, well, if there's no meaning to life, well, then it's really up to us to be the gods. It's up to us to be compassionate and caring and create the world that is the best for everyone, a world that works.
And even if there is a God, you can't imagine God would be too upset that people decide to take care of each other and make the world a better place.
Right. Show a little initiative, you know. It wouldn't hurt. It wouldn't hurt.
Well, Jason, thanks so much for being on Team Human. This is a great hour. Thanks for joining Team Human. Our guest today was the author of John Dee and the Empire of Angels, Jason Liu. You can find out more about Jason his books, and his online classes in magic, technology, and the blockchain at jasonlouv.com. That's Jason, LOUV.com, and magic.me. We'll be back in the basement media squad at Queens College Laboratory for Digital Humanism next week with more of humanity's strange and wonderful efforts at evolution. We are entirely worker and listener supported. You can join the team by subscribing at Patreon. You can also help the show by reviewing Team Human on iTunes. We put a link in the episode description in your podcast player. We're also broadcasting on a few college and community stations. If you want us on yours, please email Stephen at teamhuman.fm. That's Stephen with a PH at teamhuman.fm. This is Team Human, our last best hope for peace.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.